My apartment closed behind me, I let out a sigh of relief. I was living at the top of one of the college's faculty staircases, in lodgings reserved for visiting former members. My rooms, which included a bedroom, a sitting room with a round table for dining, and a decent, if small, kitchen, were decorated with old prints and warm wainscoting. All the furniture looked as if it had been culled from previous incarnations of the senior common room and the master's house, with down-at-the-heels late 19th-century design predominant. In the kitchen, I put two slices of bread in the toaster and poured myself a cold glass of water. Gulping it down, I opened the window to let cool air into the stuffy rooms. Carrying my snack back into the sitting room, I kicked off my shoes and turned on the small stereo. The pure tones of Mozart filled the air. When I sat on one of the maroon-upholstered sofas, it was with the intention to rest for a few moments, then take a bath and go over my notes from the day. At 3:30 in the morning, I woke with a pounding heart, a stiff neck, and the strong taste of cloves in my mouth. I got a fresh glass of water and closed the kitchen window. It was chilly, and I shivered at the touch of the damp air. After a glance at my watch and some quick calculations, I decided to call home. It was only 10:30 there, and Sarah and M were as nocturnal as bats. Slipping around the rooms, I turned off all the lights except the one in my bedroom and picked up my mobile. I was out of my grimy clothes in a matter of minutes. How do you get so filthy in a library? And into a pair of old yoga pants and a black sweater with a stretched-out neck. They were more comfortable than any pajamas. The bed felt welcoming and firm underneath me, comforting me enough that I almost convinced myself a phone call home was unnecessary. But the water hadn't been able to remove the vestiges of cloves from my tongue, and I dialed the number. "We've been waiting for your call," were the first words I heard. "Witches." I sighed. "Sarah, I'm fine." "All signs to the contrary." As usual, my mother's younger sister was not going to pull any punches. "Tabitha has been skittish all evening. Em got a very clear picture of you lost in the woods at night, and I haven't been able to eat anything since breakfast." The real problem was that damn cat. Tabitha was Sarah's baby, and picked up any tension within the family with uncanny precision. "I'm fine. I had an unexpected encounter in the library tonight, that's all." A click told me that M had picked up the extension. "Why aren't you celebrating Maybon?" she asked. Emily Mather had been a fixture in my life for as long as I could remember. She and Rebecca Bishop had met as high school students, working in the summer at Plymouth Plantation, where they dug holes and pushed wheelbarrows for the archaeologists. They became best friends, then devoted pen pals when Emily went to Vassar and my mother to Harvard. Later, the two reconnected in Cambridge when Em became a children's librarian. After my parents' death, Em's long weekends in Madison soon led to a new job in the local elementary school. She and Sarah became inseparable partners, even though Em had maintained her own apartment in town, and the two of them had made a big deal of never being seen headed into a bedroom together while I was growing up. This didn't fool me, the neighbors, or anyone else living in town. Everyone treated them like the couple they were, regardless of where they slept. When I moved out of the Bishop house, Em moved in and had been there ever since. Like my mother and my aunt, Em came from a long line of witches. I was invited to a coven's party, but worked instead. "Did the witch from Bryn Mawr ask you to go?" Em was interested in the classicist, mostly, it had turned out, over a fair amount of wine one summer night, because she had once dated Jillian's mother. "It was the 60s, was all Em would say. "Yes." I sounded harassed. The two of them were convinced I was going to see the light and begin taking my magic seriously now that I was safely tenured. Nothing cast any doubt on this wishful prognostication, and they were always thrilled when I had any contact with a witch. But I spent the night with Elias Ashmole instead. "Who's he?" Em asked Sarah. You know, that dead guy who collected alchemy books, was Sarah's muffled reply. Still here, you two, I called into the phone. So who rattled your cage? Sarah asked. Given that both were witches, there was no point in trying to hide anything. I met a vampire in the library, one I've never seen before, named Matthew Claremont. There was silence on M's end as she flipped through her mental card file of notable creatures. Sarah was quiet for a moment, too, deciding whether or not to explode. I hope he's easier to get rid of than the demons you have a habit of attracting, she said sharply. Demons haven't bothered me since I stopped acting. No, there was that demon who followed you into the Beinecke Library when you first started working at Yale, too, M corrected me. He was just wandering down the street and came looking for you. He was mentally unstable, I protested. Like using witchcraft on the washing machine, the fact that I'd somehow caught the attention of a single, curious demon shouldn't count against me. You draw creatures like flowers draw bees, Diana. But demons aren't half as dangerous as vampires. Stay away from him, Sarah said tightly. I have no reason to seek him out. My hands traveled to my neck again. We have nothing in common. That's not the point, Sarah said, voice rising. Witches, vampires, and demons aren't supposed to mix, you know that. Humans are more likely to notice us when we do. No demon or vampire is worth the risk. The only creatures in the world that Sarah took seriously were other witches. Humans struck her as unfortunate little beings, blind to the world around them. Demons were perpetual teenagers who couldn't be trusted. Vampires were well below cats and at least one step below mutts within her hierarchy of creatures. You've told me the rules before, Sarah. Not everyone obeys the rules, honey, Em observed. What did he want? He said he was interested in my work, but he's a scientist, so that's hard to believe. My fingers fiddled with the duvet cover on the bed. He invited me to dinner. To dinner? Sarah was incredulous. Em just laughed. There's not much on a restaurant menu that would appeal to a vampire. I'm sure I won't see him again. He's running 3 labs from the look of his business card, and he holds 2 faculty positions. Typical, Sarah muttered. That's what happens when you have too much time on your hands. And stop picking at that quilt. You'll put a hole in it. She'd switched on her witch's radar full blast and was now seeing as well as hearing me. It's not as if he's stealing money from old ladies and squandering other people's fortunes on the stock market, I countered. The fact that vampires were reputed to be fabulously wealthy was a sore spot with Sarah. He's a biochemist and a physician of some sort, interested in the brain. I'm sure that's fascinating, Diana, but what did he want? Sarah matched my irritation with impatience, the 1-2 punch mastered by all bishop women. Not dinner, M said with certainty. Sarah snorted. He wanted something. Vampires and witches don't go on dates. Unless he was planning to dine on you, of course. They love nothing more than the taste of a witch's blood. Maybe he was just curious. Or maybe he does like your work. Em said it with such doubt that I had to laugh. We wouldn't be having this conversation at all if you'd just take some elementary precautions, Sarah said tartly. A protection spell, some use of your abilities as a seer, and I'm not using magic or witchcraft to figure out why a vampire asked me to dinner, I said firmly. Not negotiable, Sarah. Then don't call us looking for answers when you don't want to hear them, Sarah said, her notoriously short temper flaring. She hung up before I could think of a response. Sarah does worry about you, you know, Em said apologetically. And she doesn't understand why you won't use your gifts, not even to protect yourself. Because the gifts had strings attached, as I'd explained before. I tried again. It's a slippery slope, Em. I protect myself from a vampire in the library today, and tomorrow I protect myself from a hard question at a lecture. Soon I'll be picking research topics based on knowing how they'll turn out and applying for grants that I'm sure to win. It's important to me that I've made my reputation on my own. If I start using magic, nothing will belong entirely to me. I don't want to be the next Bishop Witch. I opened my mouth to tell M about Ashmole 782, but something made me close it again. I know, honey. M's voice was soothing. I do understand. But Sarah can't help worrying about your safety. You're all the family she has now. My fingers slid through my hair and came to rest at my temples. Conversations like this always led back to my mother and father. I hesitated, reluctant to mention my one lingering concern. What is it? Em asked, her sixth sense picking up on my discomfort. He knew my name. I've never seen him before, but he knew who I was. Em considered the possibilities. Your picture's on the inside of your latest book cover, isn't it? My breath, which I hadn't been aware I was holding, came out with a soft whoosh. Yes, that must be it. I'm just being silly. Can you give Sarah a kiss from me? You bet. And, Diana, be careful. English vampires may not be as well behaved around witches as the American ones are. I smiled, thinking of Matthew Claremont's formal bow. I will, but don't worry. I probably won't see him again. M was quiet. M? I prompted. Time will tell. M wasn't as good at seeing the future as my mother was reputed to have been, but something was niggling at her. Convincing a witch to share a vague premonition was almost impossible. She wasn't going to tell me what worried her about Matthew Claremont. Not yet. Chapter 3. The vampire sat in the shadows on the curved expanse of the bridge that spanned New College Lane and connected two parts of Hartford College, his back resting against the worn stone of one of the college's newer buildings and his feet propped up on the bridge's roof. The witch appeared, moving surprisingly surely across the uneven stones of the sidewalk outside the Bodleian. She passed underneath him, her pace quickening. Her nervousness made her look younger than she was and accentuated her vulnerability. So that's the formidable historian, he thought wryly, mentally going over her vita. Even after looking at her picture, Matthew expected Bishop to be older, given her professional accomplishments. Diana Bishop's back was straight and her shoulders square, in spite of her apparent agitation. Perhaps she wouldn't be as easy to intimidate as he'd hoped. Her behavior in the library had suggested as much. She'd met his eyes without a trace of the fear that Matthew had grown to rely upon from those who weren't vampires, and many of those who were. When Bishop rounded the corner, Matthew crept along the roof lines until he reached the New College wall. He slipped silently down into its boundaries. The vampire knew the college's layout and had anticipated where her rooms would be. He was already tucked into a doorway opposite her staircase when she began her climb. Matthew's eyes followed her around the apartment as she moved from room to room, turning on the lights. She pushed the kitchen window open, left it ajar, disappeared.
That will save me from breaking the window or picking her lock, he thought.
Matthew darted across the open space and scaled her building, his feet and hands finding sure holds in the old mortar with the help of a copper downspout and some robust vines. From his new vantage point, he could detect the witch's distinctive scent and the rustle of turning pages. He craned his neck to peer into the window. Bishop was reading. In repose, her face looked different, he reflected. It was as if her skin fit the underlying bones properly. Her head bobbed slowly, and she slid against the cushions with a soft sigh of exhaustion. Soon the sound of regular breathing told Matthew she was asleep. He swung out from the wall and kicked his feet up and through the witch's kitchen window. It had been a very long time since the vampire had climbed into a woman's rooms. Even then, the occasions were rare, and usually linked to moments when he was in the grip of infatuation. This time there was a far different reason. Nonetheless, if someone caught him, he'd have a hell of a time explaining what it was. Matthew had to know if Ashmole 782 was still in Bishop's possession. He hadn't been able to search her desk at the library, but a quick glance had suggested that it wasn't among the manuscripts she'd been consulting today. Still, there was no chance that a witch, a bishop, would have let the volume slip through her fingers. With inaudible steps, he traveled through the small set of rooms. The manuscript wasn't in the witch's bathroom or her bedroom. He crept quietly past the couch where she lay sleeping. The witch's eyelids were twitching as if she were watching a movie only she could see. One of her hands was drawn into a fist, and every now and then her legs danced. Bishop's face was serene, however, unperturbed by whatever the rest of her body thought it was doing. Something wasn't right. He'd sensed it from the first moment he saw Bishop in the library. Matthew crossed his arms and studied her, but he still couldn't figure out what it was. This witch didn't give off the usual scents, henbane, sulfur, and sage. She's hiding something, the vampire thought, something more than the lost manuscript. Matthew turned away, seeking out the table she was using as a desk. It was easy to spot, littered with books and papers. That was the likeliest place for her to have put the smuggled volume. As he took a step toward it, he smelled electricity and froze. Light was seeping from Diana Bishop's body, all around the edges, escaping from her pores. The light was a blue so pale it was almost white, and at first it formed a cloud-like shroud that clung to her for a few seconds. For a moment she seemed to shimmer. Matthew shook his head in disbelief. It was impossible. It had been centuries since he'd seen such a luminous outpouring from a witch. But other, more urgent matters beckoned, and Matthew resumed the hunt for the manuscript, hurriedly searching through the items on her desk. He ran his fingers through his hair in frustration. The witch's scent was everywhere, distracting him. Matthew's eyes returned to the couch. Bishop was stirring and shifting again, her knees creeping toward her chest. Once more, luminosity pulsed to the surface, shimmered for a moment, retreated. Matthew frowned, puzzled at the discrepancy between what he'd overheard last night and what he was witnessing with his own eyes. Two witches had been gossiping about Ashmole 782, and the witch who'd called it. One had suggested that the American historian didn't use her magical power, but Matthew had seen it in the Bodleian, and now watched it wash through her with evident intensity. He suspected she used magic in her scholarship, too. Many of the men she wrote about had been friends of his. Cornelius Drebbel, Andreas Libavius, Isaac Newton. She'd captured their quirks and obsessions perfectly. Without magic, how could a modern woman understand men who had lived so long ago? Fleetingly, Matthew wondered if Bishop would be able to understand him with the same uncanny accuracy. The clocks struck 3, startling him. His throat felt parched. He realized he'd been standing for several hours, motionless, watching the witch dream while her power rose and fell in waves. He briefly considered slaking his thirst with this witch's blood. A taste of it might reveal the location of the missing volume and indicate what secrets the witch was keeping. But he restrained himself. It was only his desire to find Ashmole 782 that made him linger with the enigmatic Diana Bishop. If the manuscript wasn't in the witch's rooms, then it was still in the library. He padded to the kitchen, slid out the window, and melted into the night. Chapter 4 4 hours later, I woke up on top of the duvet, clutching the phone. At some point, I'd kicked off my right slipper, leaving my foot trailing over the edge of the bed. I looked at the clock and groaned. There was no time for my usual trip to the river, or even for a run. Cutting my morning ritual short, I showered and then drank a scalding cup of tea while drying my hair. It was straw blonde and unruly, despite the ministrations of a hairbrush. Like most witches, I had a problem getting the shoulder-length strands to stay put. Sarah blamed it on pent-up magic and promised that the regular use of my power would keep the static electricity from building and make my hair more obedient. After brushing my teeth, I slipped on a pair of jeans, a fresh white blouse, and a black jacket. It was a familiar routine, and this was my habitual outfit, but neither proved comforting today. My clothes seemed confining, and I felt self-conscious in them. I jerked on the jacket to see if that would make it fit any better, but it was too much to expect from inferior tailoring. When I looked into the mirror, my mother's face stared back. I could no longer remember when I'd developed this strong resemblance to her, sometime in college, perhaps. No one had commented on it until I came home for Thanksgiving break during freshman year. Since then, it was the first thing I heard from those who had known Rebecca Bishop. Today's check in the mirror also revealed that my skin was pale from lack of sleep. This made my freckles, which I'd inherited from my father, stand out in apparent alarm, and the dark blue circles under my eyes made them appear lighter than usual. Fatigue also managed to lengthen my nose and render my chin more pronounced. I thought of the immaculate Professor Claremont and wondered what he looked like first thing in the morning. Probably just as pristine as he had last night, I decided. The beast. I grimaced at my reflection. On my way out the door, I stopped and surveyed my rooms. Something niggled at me. A forgotten appointment, a deadline. There was something I was missing that was important. The sense of unease wrapped around my stomach, squeezed, then let go. After checking my date book and the stacks of mail on my desk, I wrote it off as hunger and went downstairs. The obliging ladies in the kitchen offered me toast when I passed by. They remembered me as a graduate student and still tried to force-feed me custard and apple pie when I looked stressed. Munching on toast and slipping along the cobblestones of New College Lane was enough to convince me that last night had been a dream. My hair swung against my collar and my breath showed in the crisp air. Oxford is quintessentially normal in the morning, with the delivery vans pulled up to college kitchens, the aroma of burned coffee and damp pavement, and fresh rays of sunlight slanting through the mist. It was not a place that seemed likely to harbor vampires. The Bodleian's blue-jacketed attendant went through his usual routine of scrutinizing my reader's card as if he'd never seen me before and suspected I might be a master book thief. Finally, he waved me through. I deposited my bag in the cubbyholes by the door after first removing my wallet, computer, and notes, and then I headed up the twisting wooden stairs to the third floor. The smell of the library always lifted my spirits. That peculiar combination of old stone, dust, woodworm, and paper made properly from rags. Sun streamed through the windows on the staircase landings, illuminating the dust motes flying through the air, and shining bars of light on the ancient walls. There the sun highlighted the curling announcements for last term's lecture series. New posters had yet to go up, but it would only be a matter of days before the floodgates opened and a wave of undergraduates arrived to disrupt the city's tranquility. Humming quietly to myself, I nodded to the busts of Thomas Bodley and King Charles I that flanked the arched entrance to Duke Humphrey's and pushed through the swinging gate by the call desk. "We'll have to set him up in the Selden End today," the supervisor was saying with a touch of exasperation. The library had been open for just a few minutes, but Mr. Johnson and his staff were already in a flap. I'd seen this kind of behavior before, but only when the most distinguished scholars were expected. "He's already put in his requests, and he's waiting down there." The unfamiliar female attendant from yesterday scowled at me and shifted the stack of books in her arms. "These are his, too. He had them sent up from the new Bodleian reading room." That's where they kept the East Asia books. It wasn't my field, and I quickly lost interest. "Get those to him now, and tell him we'll bring the manuscripts down within the hour." The supervisor sounded harassed as he returned to his office. Sean rolled his eyes heavenward as I approached the collection desk. "Hi, Diana. Do you want the manuscripts you put on reserve?" "Thanks," I whispered, thinking of my waiting stack with relish. "Big day, huh?" "Apparently," he said dryly, before disappearing into the locked cage that held the manuscripts overnight. He returned with my stack of treasures.
Here you go.
Seat number? A4. It's where I always sat, in the far southeastern corner of the Selden End, where the natural light was best. Mr. Johnson came scurrying toward me.
Ah, Dr. Bishop, we've put Professor Claremont in A3. You might prefer to sit in A1 or A6.
He shifted nervously from one foot to the other and pushed his glasses up, blinking at me through the thick glass. I stared at him.
Professor Claremont?
Yes, he's working on the Needham papers and requested good light and room to spread out.
Joseph Needham, the historian of Chinese science? Somewhere around my solar plexus, my blood started to seethe.
Yes, he was a biochemist too, of course, hence Professor Claremont's interest, Mr. Johnson explained, looking more flustered by the moment. Would you like to sit in A1?
I'll take A6.
The thought of sitting next to a vampire, even with an empty seat between us, was deeply unsettling. Sitting across from one in A4 was unthinkable, however. How could I concentrate, wondering what those strange eyes were seeing? Had the desks in the medieval wing been more comfortable, I would have parked myself under one of the gargoyles that guarded the narrow windows and braved Gillian Chamberlain's prim disapproval instead.
Oh, that's splendid. Thank you for understanding, Mr. Johnson sighed with relief.
As I came into the light of the Selden End, my eyes narrowed. Claremont looked immaculate and rested, his pale skin startling against his dark hair. This time his open-necked gray sweater had flecks of green, and his collar stood up slightly in the back. A peek under the table revealed charcoal-gray trousers, matching socks, and black shoes that surely cost more than the average academic's entire wardrobe. The unsettled feeling returned. What was Claremont doing in the library? Why wasn't he in his lab? Making no effort to muffle my footsteps, I strode in the vampire's direction. Claremont, seated diagonally across from me at the far end of the cluster of desks, and seemingly oblivious to my approach, continued reading. I dumped my plastic bag and manuscripts onto the space marked A5, staking out the outer edges of my territory. He looked up, brows arched in apparent surprise.
Dr. Bishop, good morning.
Professor Claremont? It occurred to me that he'd overheard everything said about him at the reading room's entrance, given that he had the hearing of a bat. I refused to meet his eyes and started pulling individual items out of my bag, building a small fortification of desk supplies between me and the vampire. Claremont watched until I ran out of equipment, then lowered his eyebrows in concentration and returned to his reading. I took out the cord from my computer and disappeared under the desk to shove it into the power strip. When I righted myself, he was still reading, but was also trying not to smile.
"Surely you'd be more comfortable in the northern end," I grumbled under my breath, rooting around for my list of manuscripts.
Claremont looked up, dilating pupils making his eyes suddenly dark.
"Am I bothering you, Dr. Bishop?"
"Of course not," I said hastily, my throat closing at the sudden, sharp aroma of cloves that accompanied his words. "But I'm surprised you find a southern exposure comfortable."
"You don't believe everything you read, do you?"
One of his thick, black eyebrows rose in the shape of a question mark. "If you're asking whether I think you're going to burst into flames the moment the sunlight hits you, the answer is no." Vampires didn't burn at the touch of sunlight, nor did they have fangs. These were human mids. "But I've never met someone like you who liked to bask in its glow, either." Claremont's body remained still, but I could have sworn he was repressing a laugh.
"How much direct experience have you had, Dr. Bishop, with someone like me?"
How did he know I hadn't had much experience with vampires? Vampires had preternatural senses and abilities, but no supernatural ones, like mind-reading or precognition. Those belonged to witches, and, on rare occasions, could sometimes crop up in demons, too. This was the natural order, or so my aunt had explained when I was a child and couldn't sleep for fear that a vampire would steal my thoughts and fly out the window with them. I studied him closely. Somehow, Professor Claremont, I don't think years of experience would tell me what I need to know right now.
I'd be happy to answer your question if I can, he said, closing his book and placing it on the desk. He waited with the patience of a teacher listening to a belligerent and not very bright student.
What is it that you want? Claremont sat back in his chair, his hands resting easily on the arms.
I want to examine Dr. Needham's papers and study the evolution of his ideas on morphogenesis. Morphogenesis?
The changes to embryonic cells that result in differentiation. I know what morphogenesis is, Professor Claremont. That's not what I'm asking. His mouth twitched. I crossed my arms protectively across my chest.
I see.
He tented his long fingers, resting his elbows on the chair.
I came into Bodley's library last night to request some manuscripts. Once inside, I decided to look around a bit. I like to know my environment, you understand, and don't often spend time here. There you were in the gallery. And, of course, what I saw after that was quite unexpected.
His mouth twitched again. I flushed at the memory of how I'd used magic just to get a book, and I tried not to be disarmed by his old-fashioned use of Bodley's library, but was not entirely successful. Careful, Diana, I warned myself. He's trying to charm you. So your story is that this has just been a set of odd coincidences, culminating in a vampire and a witch sitting across from each other and examining manuscripts like two ordinary readers?
I don't think anyone who took the time to examine me carefully would think I was ordinary, do you?
Claremont's already quiet voice dropped to a mocking whisper, and he tilted forward in his chair. His pale skin caught the light and seemed to glow.
But otherwise, yes. It's just a series of coincidences, easily explained.
I thought scientists didn't believe in coincidences anymore. He laughed softly. Some have to believe in them. Claremont kept staring at me, which was unnerving in the extreme. The female attendant rolled the reading room's ancient wooden cart up to the vampire's elbow, boxes of manuscripts neatly arrayed on the trolley's shelves. The vampire dragged his eyes from my face.
Thank you, Valerie. I appreciate your assistance.
Of course, Professor Claremont.
Valerie said, gazing at him raptly and turning pink. The vampire had charmed her with no more than a thank you, I snorted.
Do let us know if you need anything else, she said, returning to her bolt hole by the entrance.
Claremont picked up the first box, undid the string with his long fingers, and glanced across the table.
I don't want to keep you from your work.
Matthew Claremont had taken the upper hand. I'd had enough dealings with senior colleagues to recognize the signs and to know that any response would only make the situation worse. I opened my computer, punched the power button with more force than necessary, and picked up the first of my manuscripts. Once the box was unfastened, I placed its leather-bound contents on the cradle in front of me. Over the next hour and a half, I read the first pages at least 30 times. I started at the beginning, reading familiar lines of poetry attributed to George Ripley that promised to reveal the secrets of the Philosopher's Stone. Given the surprises of the morning, the poem's descriptions of how to make the green lion, create the black dragon, and concoct a mystical blood from chemical ingredients were even more opaque than usual. Claremont, however, got a prodigious amount done, covering pages of creamy paper with rapid strokes of his Mont Blanc Meisterstruck mechanical pencil. Every now and again, he'd turn over a sheet with a rustle that set my teeth on edge and begin once more. Occasionally, Mr. Johnson drifted through the room, making sure no one was defacing the books. The vampire kept writing. I glared at both of them. At 10:45, there was a familiar tingle when Gillian Chamberlain bustled into the Selden End. She started toward me, no doubt to tell me what a splendid time she'd had at the Maybon dinner. Then she saw the vampire and dropped her plastic bag full of pencils and paper. He looked up and stared until she scampered back to the medieval wing. At 11:10, I felt the insidious pressure of a kiss on my neck. It was the confused, caffeine-addicted demon from the music reference room. He was repeatedly twirling a set of white plastic headphones around his fingers, then unwinding them to send them spinning through the air. The demon saw me, nodded at Matthew, and sat at one of the computers in the center of the room. A sign was taped to the screen. Out of order, technician called. He remained there for the next several hours, glancing over his shoulder and then at the ceiling periodically, as if trying to figure out where he was and how he'd gotten there. I returned my attention to George Ripley, Claremont's eyes cold on the top of my head. At 11:40, icy patches bloomed between my shoulder blades. This was the last straw. Sarah always said that 1 in 10 beings was a creature, but in Duke Humphreys this morning, the creatures outnumbered humans 5 to 1. Where had they all come from? I stood abruptly and whirled around, frightening a cherubic, tonsured vampire with an armful of medieval missiles just as he was lowering himself into a chair that was much too small for him. He let out a squeak at the sudden, unwanted attention. At the sight of Claremont, he turned a whiter shade than I thought was possible, even for a vampire. With an apologetic bow, he scuttled off to the library's dimmer recesses. Over the course of the afternoon, a few humans and 3 more creatures entered the Selden End. 2 unfamiliar female vampires who appeared to be sisters glided past Claremont and came to a stop among the local history shelves under the window, picking up volumes about the early settlement of Bedfordshire and Dorset, and writing notes back and forth on a single pad of paper. One of them whispered something, and Claremont's head swiveled so fast it would have snapped the neck of a lesser being. He made a soft hissing sound that ruffled the hair on my own neck. The 2 exchanged looks and departed as quietly as they had appeared. The 3rd creature was an elderly man who stood in a full beam of sunlight and stared raptly at the leaded windows before turning his eyes to me. He was dressed in familiar academic garb, brown tweed jacket with suede elbow patches, corduroy pants in a slightly jarring tone of green, and a cotton shirt with a button-down collar and ink stains on the pocket. And I was ready to dismiss him as just another Oxford scholar before my skin tingled to tell me that he was a witch. Still, he was a stranger, and I returned my attention to my manuscript. A gentle sensation of pressure on the back of my skull made it impossible to keep reading, however. The pressure flitted to my ears, growing in intensity as it wrapped around my forehead, and my stomach clenched in panic. This was no longer a silent greeting, but a threat. Why, though, would he be threatening me? The wizard strolled toward my desk with apparent casualness. As he approached, a voice whispered in my now throbbing head. It was too faint to distinguish the words. I was sure it was coming from this male witch, but who on earth was he? My breath became shallow. "Get the hell out of my head," I said fiercely, if silently, touching my forehead. Claremont moved so quickly I didn't see him round the desks. In an instant, he was standing with one hand on the back of my chair and the other resting on the surface in front of me. His broad shoulders were curved around me like the wings of a falcon shielding his prey. "Are you all right?" he asked. "I'm fine," I replied with a shaking voice, utterly confused as to why a vampire would need to protect me from another witch. In the gallery above us, a reader craned her neck to see what all the fuss was about. She stood, her brow creased. 2 witches and a vampire were impossible for a human to ignore. "Leave me alone. The humans have noticed us," I said between clenched teeth. Claremont straightened to his full height, but kept his back to the witch and his body angled between us like an avenging angel. "Ah, my mistake," the witch murmured from behind Claremont. "I thought this seat was available. Excuse me." Soft steps retreated into the distance, and the pressure on my head gradually subsided. A slight breeze stirred as the vampire's cold hand reached toward my shoulder, stopped, and returned to the back of the chair. Claremont leaned over.
"You look quite pale," he said in his soft, low voice. "Would you like me to take you home?"
"No." I shook my head, hoping he would go sit down and let me gather my composure. In the gallery, the human reader kept a wary eye on us.
"Dr. Bishop, I really think you should let me take you home."
"No!"
My voice was louder than I intended. It dropped to a whisper.
"I am not being driven out of this library, not by you, not by anyone."
Claremont's face was disconcertingly close.
He took a slow breath in, and once again there was a powerful aroma of cinnamon and cloves.
Something in my eyes convinced him I was serious, and he drew away. His mouth flattened into a severe line, and he returned to his seat.
We spent the remainder of the afternoon in a state of détente. I tried to read beyond the second folio of my manuscript, and Claremont leafed through scraps of paper and closely written notebooks with the attention of a judge deciding on a capital case. By 3 o'clock, my nerves were so frayed that I could no longer concentrate. The day was lost. I gathered my scattered belongings and returned the manuscript to its box. Claremont looked up.
"Going home, Dr. Bishop?"
His tone was mild, but his eyes glittered.
"Yes," I snapped.
The vampire's face went carefully blank. Every creature in the library watched me on my way out. The threatening wizard, Jillian, the vampire monk, even the demon. The afternoon attendant at the collection desk was a stranger to me because I never left at this time of day. Mr. Johnson pushed his chair back slightly, saw it was me, and looked at his watch in surprise. In the quadrangle, I pushed the glass doors of the library open and drank in the fresh air. It would take more than fresh air, though, to turn the day around. 15 minutes later, I was in a pair of fitted, calf-length pants that stretched in 6 different directions, a faded New College Boat Club tank, and a fleece pullover. After tying on my sneakers, I set off for the river at a run. When I reached it, some of my tension had already abated. Adrenaline poisoning, one of my doctors had called these surges of anxiety that had troubled me since childhood. The doctors explained that, for reasons they couldn't understand, my body seemed to think it was in a constant state of danger. One of the specialists my aunt consulted explained earnestly that it was a biochemical leftover from hunter-gatherer days. I'd be all right so long as I rid my bloodstream of the adrenaline load by running, just as a frightened ibex would run from a lion. Unfortunately for that doctor, I'd gone to the Serengeti with my parents as a child and had witnessed such a pursuit. The ibex lost. It had made quite an impression on me. Since then, I'd tried medication and meditation, but nothing was better for keeping panic at bay than physical activity. In Oxford, it was rowing each morning before the college crews turned the narrow river into a thoroughfare. But the university was not yet in session, and the river would be clear this afternoon. My feet crunched against the crushed gravel paths that led to the boathouses. I waved at Pete, the boatman who prowled around with wrenches and tubs of grease, trying to put right what the undergraduates mangled in the course of their training. I stopped at the 7th boathouse and bent over to ease the stitch in my side before retrieving the key from the top of the light outside the boathouse doors. Racks of white and yellow boats greeted me inside. There were big, 8-seated boats for the first men's crew, slightly leaner boats for the women, and other boats of decreasing quality and size. A sign hung from the bow of one shiny new boat that hadn't been rigged yet, instructing visitors that no one may take the French lieutenant's woman out of this house without the permission of the NCBC president. The boat's name was freshly stenciled on the side in a Victorian-style script, in homage to the new college graduate who had created the character. At the back of the boathouse, a whisper of a boat under 12 inches wide and more than 25 feet long rested in a set of slings positioned at hip level. God bless Pete, I thought. He'd taken to leaving the skull on the floor of the boathouse. A note resting on the seat read, College training next Monday. Boat will be back in racks. I kicked off my sneakers, picked two oars with curving blades from the stash near the doors, and carried them down to the dock. Then I went back for the boat. I plopped the skull gently into the water and put one foot on the seat to keep it from floating away while I threaded the oars into the oarlocks. Holding both oars in one hand, like a pair of oversized chopsticks, I carefully stepped into the boat and pushed the dock with my left hand. The skull floated out onto the river. Rowing was a religion for me, composed of a set of rituals and movements repeated until they became a meditation. The rituals began the moment I touched the equipment, but its real magic came from the combination of precision, rhythm, and strength that rowing required. Since my undergraduate days, rowing had instilled a sense of tranquility in me like nothing else. My oars dipped into the water and skimmed along the surface. I picked up the pace, powering through each stroke with my legs and feeling the water when my blade swept back and slipped under the waves. The wind was cold and sharp, cutting through my clothes with every stroke. As my movements flowed into a seamless cadence, it felt as though I were flying. During these blissful moments, I was suspended in time and space, nothing but a weightless body on a moving river. My swift little boat darted along, and I swung in perfect unison with the boat and its oars. I closed my eyes and smiled, the events of the day fading in significance. The sky darkened behind my closed lids, and the booming sound of traffic overhead indicated that I'd passed underneath the Donington Bridge. Coming through into the sunlight on the other side, I opened my eyes and felt the cold touch of a vampire's gaze on my sternum. A figure stood on the bridge, his long coat flapping around his knees. Though I couldn't see his face clearly, the vampire's considerable height and bulk suggested that it was Matthew Claremont. Again. I swore and nearly dropped one oar. The City of Oxford dock was nearby. The notion of pulling an illegal maneuver and crossing the river so that I could smack the vampire upside his beautiful head with whatever piece of boat equipment was handy was very tempting. While formulating my plan, I spotted a slight woman standing on the dock wearing paint-stained overalls. She was smoking a cigarette and talking into a mobile phone. This was not a typical sight for the City of Oxford boathouse. She looked up, her eyes nudging my skin. A demon. She twisted her mouth into a wolfish smile and said something into the phone. This was just too weird. First Claremont and now a host of creatures appearing whenever he did? Abandoning my plan, I poured my unease into my rowing. I managed to get down the river, but the serenity of the outing had evaporated. Turning the boat in front of the Isis Tavern, I spotted Claremont standing beside one of the pub's tables. He'd managed to get there from the Donington Bridge, on foot, in less time than I'd done it in a racing skull. Pulling hard on both oars, I lifted them 2 feet off the water like the wings of an enormous bird and glided straight into the tavern's rickety wooden dock. By the time I'd climbed out, Claremont had crossed the 20-odd feet of grass lying between us. His weight pushed the floating platform down slightly in the water, and the boat wiggled in adjustment. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" I demanded, stepping clear of the blade and across the rough planks to where the vampire now stood. My breath was ragged from exertion, my cheeks flushed. "Are you and your friends stalking me?" Claremont frowned. "They aren't my friends, Dr. Bishop." "No? I haven't seen so many vampires, witches, and demons in one place since my aunts dragged me to a pagan summer festival when I was 13. If they're not your friends, why are they always hanging around you?" I wiped the back of my hand across my forehead and pushed the damp hair away from my face. "Good God," the vampire murmured incredulously. "The rumors are true." "What rumors?" I said impatiently. "You think these things want to spend time with me?" Claremont's voice dripped with contempt and something that sounded like surprise. "Unbelievable." I worked my fleece pullover up above my shoulders and yanked it off. Claremont's eyes flickered to my collarbones, over my bare arms and down to my fingertips. I felt uncharacteristically naked in my familiar rowing clothes. "Yes," I snapped. "I've lived in Oxford. I visit every year. The only thing that's been different this time is you. Since you showed up last night, I've been pushed out of my seat in the library, stared at by strange vampires and demons, and threatened by unfamiliar witches." Claremont's arms rose slightly, as if he were going to take me by the shoulders and shake me. Though I was by no means short at just under 5'7", he was so tall that my neck had to bend sharply so I could make eye contact. Acutely aware of his size and strength relative to my own, I stepped back and crossed my arms, calling on my professional persona to steel my nerves. "They're not interested in me, Dr. Bishop. They're interested in you."
"Why? What could they possibly want from me?"
"Do you really not know why every demon, witch, and vampire south of the Midlands is following you?" There was a note of disbelief in his voice, and the vampire's expression suggested he was seeing me for the first time. "No," I said, my eyes on two men enjoying their afternoon pint at a nearby table. Thankfully, they were absorbed in their own conversation. "I've done nothing in Oxford except read old manuscripts, row on the river, prepare for my conference, and keep to myself. It's all I've ever done here. There's no reason for any creature to pay this kind of attention to me."
"Think, Diana." Claremont's voice was intense. A ripple of something that wasn't fear passed across my skin when he said my first name. "What have you been reading?" His eyelids dropped over his strange eyes, but not before I'd seen their avid expression. My aunts had warned me that Matthew Claremont wanted something. They were right. He fixed his odd, gray-rimmed black eyes on me once more. "They're following you because they believe you found something lost many years ago," he said reluctantly. "They want it back, and they think you can get it for them." I thought about the manuscripts I'd consulted over the past few days. My heart sank. There was only one likely candidate for all this attention.
"If they're not your friends, how do you know what they want?"
"I hear things, Dr. Bishop. I have very good hearing," he said patiently, reverting to his characteristic formality. "I'm also fairly observant. At a concert on Sunday evening, two witches were talking about an American, a fellow witch, who found a book in Bodley's library that had been given up for lost. Since then I've noticed many new faces in Oxford, and they make me uneasy."
"It's Mabon. That explains why the witches are in Oxford." I was trying to match his patient tone, though he hadn't answered my last question. Smiling sardonically, Claremont shook his head.
"No, it's not the equinox. It's the manuscript."
"What do you know about Ashmole 782? I asked quietly.
"Less than you do," said Claremont,
his eyes narrowing to slits. It made him look even more like a large, lethal beast.
"I've never seen it. You've held it in your hands. Where is it now, Dr. Bishop? You weren't so foolish as to leave it in your room."
I was aghast. "You think I stole it? From the Bodleian? How dare you suggest such a thing?"
"You didn't have it Monday night," he said, "and it wasn't on your desk today either."
"You are observant," I said sharply, "if you could see all that from where you were sitting. I returned it Friday, if you must know."
It occurred to me, belatedly, that he might have rifled through the things on my desk. "What's so special about the manuscript that you'd snoop through a colleague's work?"
He winced slightly, but my triumph at catching him doing something so inappropriate was blunted by a twinge of fear that this vampire was following me as closely as he obviously was.
"Simple curiosity," he said, baring his teeth. Sarah had not misled me. Vampires don't have fangs.
"I hope you don't expect me to believe that."
"I don't care what you believe, Dr. Bishop, but you should be on your guard. These creatures are serious, and when they come to understand what an unusual witch you are..."
Claremont shook his head.
"What do you mean?"
All the blood drained from my head, leaving me dizzy.
"It's uncommon these days for a witch to have so much potential.
Claremont's voice dropped to a purr that vibrated in the back of his throat.
Not everyone can see it, yet, but I can. You shimmer with it when you concentrate, when you're angry, too. Surely the demons in the library will sense it soon, if they haven't already.
I appreciate the warning, but I don't need your help. I prepared to stalk away, but his hand shot out and gripped my upper arm, stopping me in my tracks.
Don't be too sure of that. Be careful, please.
Claremont hesitated, his face shaken out of its perfect lines as he wrestled with something.
Especially if you see that wizard again.
I stared fixedly at the hand on my arm. Claremont released me. His lids dropped, shuttering his eyes. My row back to the boathouse was slow and steady, but the repetitive movements weren't able to carry away my lingering confusion and unease. Every now and again, there was a gray blur on the towpath, but nothing else caught my attention except for people bicycling home from work and a very ordinary human walking her dog. After returning the equipment and locking the boathouse, I set off down the towpath at a measured jog. Matthew Claremont was standing across the river in front of the university boathouse. I began to run, and when I looked back over my shoulder, he was gone. Chapter 5. After dinner, I sat down on the sofa by the sitting room's dormant fireplace and switched on my laptop. Why would a scientist of Claremont's caliber want to see an alchemical manuscript, even one under a spell, so much that he'd sit at the Bodleian all day, across from a witch, and read through old notes on morphogenesis? His business card was tucked into one of the pockets of my bag. I fished it out, propping it up against the screen. On the internet, below an unrelated link to a murder mystery and the unavoidable hits from social networking sites, a string of biographical listings looked promising. His faculty webpage, a Wikipedia article, and links to the current fellows of the Royal Society. I clicked on the faculty webpage and snorted. Matthew Claremont was one of those faculty members who didn't like to post any information, even academic information, on the net. On Yale's website, a visitor could get contact information and a complete vita for practically every member of the faculty. Oxford clearly had a different attitude toward privacy. No wonder a vampire taught here. There hadn't been a hit for Claremont at the hospital, though the affiliation was on his card. I typed John Radcliffe Neurosciences into the search box and was led to an overview of the department's services. There wasn't a single reference to a physician, however, only a lengthy list of research interests. Clicking systematically through the terms, I finally found him on a page dedicated to the frontal lobe, though there was no additional information. The Wikipedia article was no help at all, and the Royal Society's site was no better. Anything useful hinted at on the main pages was hidden behind passwords. I had no luck imagining what Claremont's username and password might be, and was refused access to anything at all after my sixth incorrect guess. Frustrated, I entered the vampire's name into the search engines for scientific journals. Yes. I sat back in satisfaction. Matthew Claremont might not have much of a presence on the internet, but he was certainly active in the scholarly literature. After clicking a box to sort the results by date, I was provided with a snapshot of his intellectual history. My initial sense of triumph faded. He didn't have one intellectual history. He had four. The first began with the brain. Much of it was beyond me, but Claremont seemed to have made a scientific and medical reputation at the same time by studying how the brain's frontal lobe processes urges and cravings. He'd made several major breakthroughs related to the role that neural mechanisms play in delayed gratification responses, all of which involved the prefrontal cortex. I opened a new browser window to view an anatomical diagram and locate which bit of the brain was at issue. Some argued that all scholarship is thinly veiled autobiography. My pulse jumped. Given that Claremont was a vampire, I sincerely hoped delayed gratification was something he was good at. My next few clicks showed that Claremont's work took a surprising turn away from the brain and toward wolves, Norwegian wolves, to be precise. He must have spent a considerable amount of time in the Scandinavian nights in the course of his research, which posed no problem for a vampire, considering their body temperature and ability to see in the dark.